On Sunday, the Pacific Islands Forum leaders met in Palau. A wrestle takes place each gathering between the needs of developed powers, Australia and New Zealand, and the 16 island nations of varied development levels, with some of those impatient for climate change action. Host Serengel Whips Jr. presses Australia on its climate record, with the Palau president calling the nation one of the largest contributors to global emissions. He said in a speech to the Lowry Institute that Australia had to demonstrate solidarity by phasing out coal and gas production and halting approvals of new fossil fuel projects. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Matthew Whaley is no longer attending the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders meeting in Palau after a no-confidence motion was lodged against him by Home Affairs Minister Manasa Malenga. Less than 24 hours after arriving in Palau, Mr. Whaley is flying out of the country Monday 31st to deal with domestic politics. There had been hopes that Australia could continue negotiations with the Solomons on security treaty on the sidelines of the summit. Those plans can now no longer go ahead. However, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is still planning on travelling to Palau for the leaders' meeting after he declared yesterday that Australia had a duty to help Pacific nations thrive. Australia's Prime Minister and two senior ministers have travelled to the Pacific Islands Forum in Palau. Anthony Albanese, Chris Bowen and Pat Conroy will be joining a rapidly shrinking guest list with the leaders from Fiji, Kiribati, Samoa, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. And conflicting reports about the participation of the counterparts from Nauru and New Caledonia. Kiribati President Taneti Maamau is effectively snubbing the summit by sending a senior public servant and former ambassador to China, which has alarmed Canberra because the Micronesian nation began the process of embedding ties to Beijing in its constitution last week. World Wildlife Fund Pacific Conservation Director Alfred Rolifo says Australia and New Zealand have an important role to play in finding a way through the tension and setting an example for the climate issues that will dominate the discussion.
The need for them to invest in the just transition in the Pacific towards a fossil fuel-free Pacific, but also doing the same thing at their national level, domestically, in Australia and New Zealand to transition away from fossil fuel.
The Australian government has announced a further $3 million in aid for Nepal, on top of an initial package of $5 million following the deadly floods in the country. Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong says the items will be delivered with $2 million of the additional funding, along with other humanitarian support. The Royal Australian Air Force will transport the first batch of these supplies from Queensland in the coming days. Senator Wong says the government is still trying to find out the status of 42 Australians missing in Nepal. The president of the Nepalese Association of Victoria, Sudip Shrestha, says it's been a tough time for families waiting for news on their loved ones.
Supporting people in need, I think that's the main priority, and the second priority, of course, is letting everyone know Victoria unites together, you know, for Nepal.
New South Wales Premier has begun an official trip to India as the state looks to strengthen its cultural and economic links with the Southeast Asian nation. The government says the four-day program in New Delhi and Mumbai will focus on high-level business and government engagements to strengthen economic ties, attract investment, and create new opportunities for New South Wales. New South Wales and India traded $6.87 billion worth of goods in the 2024-25 financial year, making India one of the state's most important trading partners. More than 28,000 Indian students also study in New South Wales, establishing the nation as one of the state's largest international education markets. Warning, the following story refers to sexual violence. Australians could have the ability to opt out of social media algorithms under new digital laws as leaders try to limit the spread of violent, misogynistic content online. Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek says the federal government is considering bans on pornography depicting strangulation or suffocation. A 2024 survey by the University of Melbourne found that 57% of people aged from 18 to 35 years had been strangled during sex at least once. Law professor at the University of Melbourne, Heather Douglas, researches legal responses to family violence and says her research indicates rates of strangulation or choking during sex are on the rise.
When we surveyed people, we did ask them where they found out about strangulation, and around 60% said they had been exposed to strangulation in pornography. They also said that they'd seen it in social media and also learned about it from their peers and their partners. But it was such a high proportion of people were learning about it in pornography.
The Energy Minister has clarified Labor's stance on its new policy mandating that data centres must be powered by renewable energy after concerns that some states would receive different treatment. State and territory governments met to discuss the policy in National Cabinet during the week. But following the meeting, there were questions over whether Queensland and the Northern Territory would receive carve-outs, allowing for centres in those jurisdictions to be powered by coal and gas. Mr. Bowen says the federal government will decide.
That if Queensland really thinks that they can provide data centre energy cheaper than renewables, they can put a case together, and if it genuinely turns out to be cheaper than renewables, they can apply for an exemption. The Commonwealth will decide that, not Queensland. You know, we know that renewables are the cheapest form of energy. That's why we're requiring data centres to use renewable energy, because otherwise you'd see everyone's bills go up.
A warning for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, the following story contains the name of an Indigenous person who has passed. Aboriginal Australian boxing champion Tony Mundine has died of a heart attack at age 75. Born in Burriugil, northern New South Wales, Tony Mundine was the first Australian to fight in four different weight divisions, challenging for the world middleweight title in 1974. The father of former boxer and NRL star Anthony Mundine leaves a significant boxing legacy, recording 80 wins throughout his career. His son, Anthony, has posted a tribute to his father on social media, saying he will return from Saudi Arabia to attend the funeral. And now to sport. In rugby union, Wallabies coach Les Kiss says there is likely to be changes to the team ahead of their second match of their tour in Argentina. The team beat Argentina 27-21 in their first game of the tour, in the third victory in a row for the Wallabies under Kiss since he took over at the start of August. Kiss says the team's composure in front of a hostile home crowd is to be commended, but he has told Stan Sport there are aspects of their performance that require improvement ahead of the next game against Argentina in a week's time.
It's a big challenge here in Argentina, and there's a lot of work to be done in the forward pack, so we're going to have to make some changes there for sure. Just make the smart ones. You know, we've got a couple of fresh guys that we can lean into for sure.
And now for a look at today in the weather. Adelaide is sunny at 21. Melbourne is seeing cloud clearing at 16. Hobart is partly cloudy at 17. Canberra is sunny at 21. Sydney is mostly sunny at 21. Wollongong is sunny at 20. Newcastle is mostly sunny at 21. Brisbane is partly cloudy at 24. Cairns is seeing showers increasing at 27. Darwin is sunny at 35. And Perth is seeing showers at 22. And that wraps up the latest in news, sport and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio. Kindred People Festival is an Indigenous-led gathering held on Bunurong country, guided by elders and an Indigenous steering committee. Each event sits within a broader program of ceremony, performance, and knowledge exchange. Joining the program at Kindred People, kicking off from the 1st to the 5th of September, is Decolonizing the Bells, a concert by Aaron Wyatt and Speak Percussion, and special guest Bell Ringers. Decolonizing the Bells asks, what's in a name? What are the consequences of symbolic power and the limits of symbolic counteraction? Have a listen to this chat with Aaron Wyatt. Yama, you're listening to NITV Radio. I'm Nari Pakai, and Aaron Wyatt is a viola player, composer and conductor, as well as an assistant lecturer. Aaron joins NITV Radio today as he engages with audiences who are going to be attending Kindred People's Festival. It's an Indigenous-led multi-day experience with performances as well as academic discussions. Thanks for jumping on and having a chat with us today, Aaron.
Oh, all good. Great to be here.
Can you introduce yourself? Who are you? Who's your mob? Where are you from?
So I'm mostly Noongar, Yamashin Wongai on my father's side. So originally from Perth and now living and working on Bunurong country in Melbourne. As I said, I'm sort of a composer and musician, and I'm sort of working on this piece for the Kindred People Festival.
Can you share with us what this audio experience is? It's called Decolonizing the Bells.
Yeah, so it's a piece for bells, like this Federation handbells, viola and electronics. And it kind of came about because I was doing an artistic residency with Speak Percussion. I was working on a completely different piece with them, and they had this suggestion to write this additional piece for the Federation handbells. So there's a set of about just over 2,000 of these bells that were created for the Centenary Federation in Melbourne and for the celebrations surrounding that. The Melbourne Museum has kind of been, you know, custodians of them for the past, well now it's like 20, 25 years since the Centenary celebrations. So they've been holding them and have been loaning them out to community organisations, and obviously have gotten sick of that process and of having to warehouse them. So they've kind of divested them, and people put in expressions of interest, and Speak Percussion, the group that I'm working with, was one of these groups who offered to take over, you know, the care of a number of sets of these bells. So the artistic director of Speak, or the former artistic director now, Eugene Ugetti, had written a piece called Bell Curve. So it was designed to be played by 12 community players who had, you know, maybe little to no formal musical training or experience, so it's a very accessible piece. And he kind of offered this piece to me as a starting point for a new work for me to create that kind of looked at the Federation handbells, particularly the baggage of the name Federation, you know, kind of examined that and looked at, well, how do we really make these an instrument for everyone? How do we strip them of their sort of colonial baggage? And so the piece Decolonizing the Bells was kind of born from that suggestion.
The concert will be performed by you, but as well as, you said, Speak Percussion, as well as a special guest with the Bell Ringers. How did you develop that work? Like, what was the collaboration process like?
Oh, yeah, so the Bell Ringers for the project, we are a mix of students from Warrawa Aboriginal College, a bunch of high school girls, and also students from Monash. And we've been working with them for a while, sort of getting them used to the score and how to read it and all those sorts of things. But I guess the development process, it's been a lot of, I guess, exploring sounds, working out how to intertwine the viola and the bells and how to build that on top of the electronics track. So the electronics for the work are all kind of, it's pieced together from a recording of Eugene's original piece, Bell Curve. So I've basically taken a full recording of that, cut it up into a lot of much smaller sections, stretched the sound of them, reversed the sound of them, and it creates quite an interesting, almost sort of surreal kind of soundscape of these sounds that are kind of bells, but also not bells because they've been so processed. And so it's kind of, yeah, it's building up this sort of gradual soundscape of electronics, bells and viola, and the creative process has mostly been kind of just seeing where things best fit and playing around with different ideas and just, you know, gradually sort of getting the work together.
With this, why is this performance a largely instrumental and musical, like, auditory experience? How is this piece significant?
The main significance of it is the way that it, well, the way that it looks at these bells and thinks about the history of bells in this country and what they've signified and what they've been used for and just the unpacking of all of that. I mean, there is a kind of ceremonial aspect to the work. So it does start outside, or will start outside the smoking ceremony without giving too much away. And there is movement that happens between the players in the space as well. So it's not entirely just an auditory experience, even though it is mostly that. But it's kind of, I guess the significance of it is that it's addressing these notions of you know, what the history of these bells are and how we can reimagine that. And the other, you know, the other big significance is that it's taking place in the Kindred People Festival, which is a really big undertaking by Monash to bring together a lot of First Nations creatives for this festival program, and also having the symposium track. So almost kind of like an academic discussion, but recognizing that there are, of course, traditional knowledge holders who, you know, don't necessarily have those standard, you know, credentials like a PhD that you would often, you know, expect to have someone to have if they were speaking at a university. Yeah, so it's, I guess that's really the main significance of it, just the whole context in which it's taking place.
And how do you hope audiences sitting in on this performance or engaging with the discussion connect with the work?
Well, I hope that they really let the sort of sound wash over them, that they can kind of enjoy it while also sort of reflecting on the content of it and the issues that it's trying to address. One of the great things about the venue as well, so it's in the David Lee Sound Gallery at Monash, which has this amazing sound system. There are about roughly also 64 speakers around the walls and in the ceiling. So the electronics can kind of be positioned, or they can be made to sound like they're coming from anywhere in the space. So depending on where you're sitting in the audience, I mean, you'll get a slightly different experience, but it'll be a very immersive one with sound sort of coming from all directions, especially since the bell ringers themselves, once again, you know, it's not a standard sort of here's the stage and here's the audience sort of vibe. The bell ringers are scattered around the room. And so, once again, both the electronics and the live sounds will sort of really surround the audience and really hopefully give them a very immersive experience.
Is there a particular part of this work or, like, a part of the process that really stuck out for you?
I guess not any one bit in particular. I think I'm really happy with how the electronics have worked, and there are some really cool moments of manipulated bells in the soundtrack to it. But I think, yeah, there's not really any one part that sort of stands out. I think I'd like to think that the work kind of just flows really nicely together as a whole.
And when it comes to the bell ringers, you said that there are multiple bell ringers, including high school students. How did they get involved with your music? Is this something that they do regularly? Do they go around just ringing bells? Like, how did they get involved in this to be a part of this work? And, you know, they're going to be performing in front of a bunch of people. How are they feeling?
They've been really great in the whole rehearsal process and really engaged and seem really excited about it. I mean, the girls from Warrawa Aboriginal College, they have a music program at the school. Most of them are in a sort of contemporary band, play other instruments. So they're not, you know, they haven't done a lot of bell playing, but they've played a lot of other stuff. And so this is very easy and straightforward for them to pick up. We kind of reached out to them, which is sort of how they got involved in the project. But mostly because we really wanted to sort of center First Nations voices in the work. So they're playing for each of the two shows. They're providing 8 of the 12 bell ringers. The other 4 are from Monash. There was just a general call out to the music students there, and they're non-Indigenous players. And it was a kind of very deliberate decision to have that sort of mix of participants to kind of show that while Indigenous voices should be centered, and, you know, that certainly shows through in the way that the players are positioned, you know, the Warrawa girls are very, you know, much central in the space. But, you know, while Indigenous voices should be central to this, it's kind of the work of everyone to question, you know, these colonial institutions and systemic inequality and racism and all those sorts of things. It's not just for Indigenous people to be doing. So that was kind of a very key, important decision on who we got involved, participant-wise.
For anyone who's looking for more information or wanting to catch the performance, where can they go? Where can people find this?
So if they just do a search for the Kindred People website, they'll find the full program of everything that's happening. So, of course, Decolonising the Bells is happening over two shows on Saturday, the 5th of September. But there are a lot of other shows sort of in the lead-up to that of all sorts of amazing Indigenous arts and creative people. So definitely worth checking out the full program as well. There's so much going on, and definitely worth checking out what's happening there.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us today, Aaron.
Awesome. No, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
That was Aaron Wyatt, viola player, composer and conductor, talking about the performance Decolonising the Bells, featuring at the Kindred Peoples Festival from the 1st to the 5th of September at the E.M. Potter Centre for Performing Arts at Monash University. I'm Nari Pakai. You're listening to NITV Radio. The 2026 National NAIDOC Awards were held in Imbabwe, Alice Springs. Each year, it recognises the outstanding contributions that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people make to improve the lives of people and their communities. In categories like Person of the Year, Lifetime Achievement, Female and Male Elder of the Year, Sportsperson Award, and many, many more, NITV Radio's Luana Grant attended the awards and has conversations with the winners and honorees, celebrated not only for their excellence, but for building better futures. A warning to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, the names of First Nations people who have passed are mentioned in the following story. Have a listen to the award recipients and their families.
I'm Sarah Robertsfield and I'm a Bundjalung Widjibal Wyabal woman from the Northern Rivers.
Yeah, and I'm Jack Robertsfield, a Widjibal Wyabal man from the Bundjalung Nation. You know, it's the little impact she did. You know, you hear that saying, like, treat people the way you want to be treated. And just from the random people that all across this nation that come up to you and go, hey, your mother did this, or your mother left such a positive impact. It's just so special, you know, like just hearing those interactions and the impact she had on those people. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just feeling so happy. Because she didn't believe that she would ever win something like this. Like, every accolade that she got, she was just like, oh, no, someone else.
Yeah.
But I'm so happy and just so honoured. She's so deserving of it. You know, if anyone deserves Lifetime Achievement Award amongst all the others that have, she's one of them. She really deserves it. It's so special.
It really is just a blessing. It's just an honour. It's just, you know, definitely just not take it for granted. There's so many ways to express it, but I'm a bit lost for words, really. But it is. It's just a great honour.
It is.
It's amazing.
Yeah, to just shine the spotlight on such a woman who did so much for mob, for country, for culture. It's just amazing. You know, I can only imagine how she would feel if she was here tonight. And I know she's here tonight, just not physically. But, you know, just this little bush girl from Lismore, she achieved so much. And she never would have thought that she could, but she did. This is everything. I mean, I think she would agree with that as well. Because, yeah, she didn't believe that she was going to get this. That's like, she just always sold herself short. She just never realised how amazing she was.
You know, one thing for our people sometimes in these remote communities, and I've just been lucky enough that we've been to some of these remote communities, and sometimes all you need is a little spotlight, a little hope. And I think
she gave that.
Yeah, and I think she gave that, you know, because that's all some of our people need, just to succeed and shine. And I think in terms of legacy, that's one of my proudest moments for her. Yeah.
Yeah, her kindness, her generosity, that's the legacy. It's just unmatched. She gave so many opportunities, opened so many doors for people, for artists, and it'll just never be forgotten. I think it'll just forever remain, and we'll continue to try our best to carry on her legacy.
Yeah.
My name is Josie Douglas, and I'm a Waterman woman from the Northern Territory, and I live in Alice Springs. She's been a tremendous mentor for me, and I have known her for many years, and I've deeply admired her work. Well, I think she's a deserving recipient of the award, and she leaves an extraordinary legacy in terms of her service to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia, and it's been a very deep honour to accept the award on behalf of Pat. Unfortunately, Pat couldn't travel to Mbantwa, Alice Springs, to accept the award herself, but I know she'd be watching at home and really enjoying the coverage. Well, Pat's pretty straight out, and people who know Pat know she doesn't mince her words, and she would have, you know, been I think deeply humbled to accept the award, but also deeply grateful to be able to have that honour and acknowledgement on Mbantwa, on Aranda country, her hometown, where she grew up as a little girl. And all of her family are still here. Her connections are still here. So I think Pat would have just been absolutely delighted to be in that room tonight with a lot of Aranda people and her own family to accept the award, but sadly she couldn't be here tonight. So that task fell to me, and it was a real privilege and an honour to accept the award for Pat Turner tonight. I think Pat would be deeply honoured to be receiving this award tonight. But Pat's always thinking, what else needs to be done? What's the next job that we need to tackle? And so I think Pat's always thinking about the next thing, the next matter in terms of protecting the rights and interests of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia. And that has been her life, a life of service and absolute dedication. And she has done it in such an extraordinary way. Pat has been able to bring people with her from all walks of life, from all sectors, from across Australia. She's been able to garnish and bring together people. People trust Pat, they respect her, and Pat knows how to maintain relationships and the importance of relationships, not only within Aboriginal affairs, but in the broader work more generally in terms of advocacy and policy, structural change, systemic change. Pat understood and understands what was needed, and she's worked tirelessly to achieve better outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. I think Pat has done tremendous amount of behind-the-scenes work that, if you know, you know. You know what Pat's done and the causes that she has supported, from when she was the most senior public servant in Australia to when she was the inaugural CEO of NITV to when she headed up NACHO. I think for me, Pat's ability to bring together and unite 80 organisations, peak bodies from across Australia, into the Coalition of Peaks, and turn the agenda of closing the gap around and inserting the four priority reforms in terms of getting government to do business differently and not accepting the status quo, I think that is a tremendous legacy of Pat. And it's something that Aboriginal leaders and organisations around Australia turn to, those four priority reforms. And one of those is working in partnership with government. And certainly, for example, in the Northern Territory, we have been able to utilise Priority Reform 1, working in partnership with government, to great effect in terms of having Aboriginal organisations, voices and leaders sitting at the table negotiating on matters that are critical to Aboriginal people. So that's Pat's legacy, and what an amazing legacy. What an amazing woman.
My name's Oscar Colbung, Meneng mob from Western Australia in the Albany.
So my name is Asha. I'm the CEO of Southern Aboriginal Corporation in Albany, Western Australia, and have been working there for the last 18 years.
Yeah, I think it's just rewarding for us to know that you know, the work that we do out there, healing the country, doesn't go unnoticed at the national level, and it's just encouraging, you know. Well, it's always been part of our lives, you know, and growing up as a young bloke, living on the land, we always seen the need to put back into it. You know, if we look after our budger, the budger will look after us. That's what we continue to do.
And this organisation is going for 43 years and built on the foundations that connection to country and connection to people are inseparable.
Mm-hmm. Like I was saying earlier, you know, it's always been part of us. We've lived on the land, never moved from it. And, you know, introducing our young people to different techniques how to look after the land is very important. And I think what it does is give them the opportunity going forward to be able to take the same attitude forward as well, you know.
And we are working continuously and tirelessly. We don't pause. And this award and recognition means, you know, reflecting back on the work that has been done by elders since the inception and continued that journey. And it shows in a strength and resilience of Aboriginal people. And we always get to hear the negative stories and to take back the trophy to Western Australia and to regional town and showcase that is testament to the hard work done by the directors and the team at Southern Aboriginal Corporation.
I mean, everyone could be proud of this, you know, because it's been a long journey. And I guess it's just a start.
We are a leading Aboriginal community-controlled organisation providing programs and services in the Great Southern, Southwest and Lower Wheat Belt area of Western Australia. And we are Noongar-led. And something to carry back to the region is extraordinary because always regional people are invisible and we always face disadvantage. Yeah. And to get this recognition on the national stage is extraordinary. Yeah.
And I guess it also, you know, enables us to meet the Closing the Gap reports as well. And that's very important, you know, through our Rangers program, caring for country, avoiding incarceration for our mob as well. I think the next generation has just got to, you know, be mindful of the foundations that were set by the elders and, you know, elders before us, you know, and take up that responsibility, look after the land and the land will look after you.
So my name is Gregory Eggert, or Uncle Che, known in my community, and I'm a proud Gurumpul, Yagara and Gubbi Gubbi man.
I'm Tanya Saltner, principal of the Murray School, Woolly Woolly Waka Waka woman, little Dawson River Murray from a tiny little town called Theodore in central Queensland.
It's amazing for what we stand for, and we stand for looking after our mob, at the same time making sure our children and our community have visions to belong in this place. And getting national recognition. The school started 40 years ago simply because our children were getting exiled from the mainstream system. And so making sure there's a community-based education system like ours that is based around our culture and our values as black people is so important for us and for our community.
You know, we strive to give our kids a place to belong, a community. Doesn't matter where they come from in this country. When they come to the Murray School, that's their community. I'd love to see another black principal straight after me. One of those kids that are sitting in those classrooms today.
It's not about us. It's about the future generations. Mm. And making sure that in four generations' time, there is a Murray School there for their children's children. Me individually and us as a collective, it's about our cultural obligation to mob. That's what drives us, to get up every day to go to school, no matter what we face. It's what we're supposed to do. It's our obligation, it's in here. And back to mob. Not to individuals, but to mob. Yeah,
We get very passionate about our little school, and it sounds, you know, but it is more than a job for us. It, like Uncle Chegg said, that's our cultural obligation to our kids and our community.
My name is Stephen Hagan, H-A-G-A-N, and I'm a Kulli man from far southwest Queensland. My father, as I said on stage, my father won this award back in 2007, which I think it's an historic occasion that I don't think a father and a son has ever won the Male Elder of the Year award. I'd be surprised if there was. Well, I hope there is one, but I don't think there is another father and son. And he was chairman of the National Aboriginal Conference, and he was the first Aboriginal to address the United Nations. So I follow a warrior from the outset. So, yeah, I'm very impressed that I'm able to do that. I've changed a brand of food item, coon cheese, to chi cheese. I've changed the N-word from a sports stadium in Queensland. I took that all the way to the United Nations. I mean, I've changed three words on Scrabble, Abba, Boong and Coon, that you can win a game of Scrabble on. I've done a lot of campaigns over the years. And, you know, I shouldn't have to do it. But I also worry that there are Aboriginal people around the nation who are also uncomfortable about my campaigns because they don't want to challenge the status quo, because they're hearing my voice on radio or seeing me on TV challenging the status quo. And yeah, non-Indigenous people don't like so-called uppity black folks like myself. And I do, because I think it's what comes natural and what I think is right. Oh, look, there's a lot of famous people from the Kulli and Kuma nations, you know, all around Australia. I mean, I got my cousin Wayne Coco Wharton, he burns flags, and he does all those bold things up front. I mean, a lot of people call me a conservative radical. I mean, I'm a former diplomat. I'm an entrepreneur, but I'm a radical person in the campaigns. So, you know, I'm just one of those conservative fellows, but who fight and fight. But you know, it's just something I do. I would like to slow down, but you know, I just can't sit back and let these injustices, you know, succeed. Because no one's challenging them. You've got to feel comfortable to take on the fight, but don't do it if you're not comfortable and if you don't feel safe, because it's a dangerous path. I've had police protection, I've had everything, but I think it's very rewarding if you can take something on and fight tirelessly and come out the other end with a victory, because you've changed something that the next generation don't have to confront. You know, the ugly public signs that I've fought against, that I've changed to food brands like coon cheese or chia cheese, you know, Scrabble, service stations for racial profiling, you name it. You know, I now know that the owners of those companies, billion-dollar companies, will think twice about daring to do those racist things.
Yeah, my name's Tyson Neil Edwards. I'm a Gunditjmara, Wadarong and Arunda man. Yeah, it's an honour to be recognised for this award and you know, be a finalist, but win it was the next level. And yeah, it means a lot for my community and I. Yeah, if I'm being honest, when I reflect on winning this award, it doesn't actually entail that, to be honest. It's probably more of a personal journey and my family's journey. And it's just like an honour to get through all that, you know, pain, but show how resilient we are. And then the work that I do on country and you know, with the IMP, being a part of that was amazing. That's just, you know, that's a good part of it, you know. So so totally lucky to do all that. But yeah, I reflect on, you know, how far we've come as a family. Definitely what motivates me is just probably being the eldest of seven, you know. For some reason, something clicked, you know, a few years ago, and I just, you know, I had to change my actions, and I just want to lead by action. And I don't really like talking much. I just, yeah, I like doing things and living a healthy life and showing that, you know, that's a possibility for my siblings and my community. I think having the blazer designed by Nan, you know, Stolen Generation Aranda woman, it's a win for her, and of course it's a win for my community back home too, which is where I do most of my work. So it's just special to be here back in Aranda country too. So it's a win for all. Stay solid and stick to your beliefs. I think we live in a crazy time where people are pulled in every which way, especially black fellas. So, you know, understand what you want and just stay solid and healthy and you know, try and leave an impact on people, because that's what really matters.
I'm Katie. I'm Lara Keir. I'm from Darwin. It's really special, to be fair. I think, like, you go throughout your career in your respective fields, and at times you see, like, you know, receive certain recognition, but this one is definitely very special, and to be back in my home territory, it feels extra special. I think by default at the moment I'm thinking about how long it took, not to get here to this, you know, pinnacle point of recognition, but I guess what that process looked like for me. So the sacrifices that my parents made, whether that be through time or, you know, the financial sacrifice to get me on these trips to build that foundation, and then when I was old enough to kind of make it my own. But yeah, definitely reflecting on all that was and all that has been to get me in this position right now. Honestly, just getting after it, I feel like I was born with, like, fire in my stomach, and my family and friends say, like, you're doing too much, or, you know, you're stretching yourself, but that's just who I am as a person. Like, I feel like I was born to get after it, and I'm constantly chasing, you know, the next big thing, and obviously sometimes I do need to slow down and enjoy the journey, but I've just always had this drive to get after it and be the best where I can be. Yeah, it is a win for Darwin, it's a win for my family. I think it's a good time to reflect on where I started. Obviously grew up in Darwin, moved to Queensland for boarding school, for sport, you know, sport opportunities, but just admiring that process and I guess the resilience it took me to, you know, come out on the other side through injuries and through sacrifices like missing my family and being away from, you know, my country. So really grateful to be here, and yeah, it is special to reflect on all that it's taken to be here. Honestly, just get after it, you know, like, you might not get there the first time, but as long as you get back up and give it a go, you will get to where you want to be. Just stay in the fight and trust the process, because there is a lot out there if you're willing to get after it.
My name is Kaylin Emmanuel Whiskey, and I'm from Indolgana, and I'm working at Indolgana Hearts, and I'm welcoming this house here. I'm glad when I win this prize, and I'm glad so all my family can hear me on the television. Thank you, family.